Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
All right, Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another great episode of Atlanta Business Radio. Stone, quite a crowd you've accumulated here.
Yes, we have assembled an excellent complement in the studio this morning. We're going to get a chance to visit with a lot of folks, including some sharks from the Shark Attack thing that Larry White and his crew down at the Ritz Group organized. And so we're going to have a lot of fun this morning, but we better get going. None of this typical idle chit-chat. Yes,
enough banter.
enough of the banter. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce up first on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, Chief Marketing Officer with Corterra. Please join me in welcoming to the show Mr. Gary Brooks. How you doing, man?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are delighted to have you on the show. Corterra, you guys do something in the space of B2B sales prospecting. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, you can look at Corterra as the rocket fuel for companies that want to accelerate revenue.
So some companies don't want to accelerate revenue?
I hope they all do. So we're a data provider. We're providing behavioral data that allows companies to better sell and market to their prospects. What we're doing is we're tracking 1.6 trillion in business-to-business purchases across 20 million companies that enable us to provide the deep insight that marketers and sales professionals need to better target the companies that they're selling to.
And you've been doing this your entire career, or how did you get started in this field?
I'm new to this career. I'm a B2B marketing addict. I've been marketing B2B products my entire career, but I'm relatively new to Corterra. I've been with the company a little over a year.
So now you're using the kind of the hot buzz phrase, big data. How are you guys using big data to help your clients?
You know, it's interesting where we are with data right now and data for the use of marketing and sales. It's an interesting paradox where we have more information than we've ever had before. We've had more data than we've ever had before, and we're more interconnected than we've ever been before through social media and through networking. But we're still struggling to figure out which companies to target. Now, you think that wouldn't be the case with all the talk about big data and all the sales tools that we have at our disposal, all the search tools that we have at our disposal, but sales and marketing professionals still struggle to figure out which companies to target.
Really? So, like, they must know what industry they're in. They know who their competitors are. They just don't know who their sales prospects are?
Well, it's a good point that you mentioned industry. Prospecting is a challenge that's plagued B2B sales and marketing professionals for decades. It's incredibly inefficient, it's ineffective, and it's very time-consuming because most focus on the industry. The way that marketers and sales professionals typically target their prospects is they will look for which industry they're in, what size of a company they are,
right,
what's their revenue, but that serves up a very large group of prospects.
Is that too large?
It's too large. Imagine going to Turner Field, 30,000 fans there,
right,
and you have a product and you want to sell to only the ones that have a high propensity to buy. If you marketed and tried to sell to all of them, it would be a very inefficient process. Imagine the ability to go out onto the mound and ask which of those companies had a high propensity to buy your product to raise their hand and only market and sell to them. You'd have a very, very effective and efficient sales and marketing process.
And that's what your tool does?
That's what we do. We help companies to identify which of their prospects have the highest propensity to buy their products.
Now, so can you take us through what an engagement looks like?
Yeah, so what we do is we take a sample set of a company's current customers.
So you look at their current customers as kind of this is what the profile, some of the qualities of the profile.
Exactly. We look at demographic information, but much importantly, we look at behavioral information. We look at what they buy, mm-hmm, how they pay, how they hire, how they invest, and how they basically conduct business. We use that information to build a behavioral profile, and with that behavioral profile, we search our database of 20 million North American companies and serve up the companies that match that profile. So rather than marketing to all 20 million, we serve up a subset that look and act like your current customers.
So this to me sounds a little bit like some of the science that might be applied in a B2C environment. Are there some lessons we can learn, B2B marketers, that we can learn from the B2C arena?
Absolutely. Behavioral profiling is something that's been done in the B2C world for decades. When you think about it, every time you use your credit card, a profile is being built on you so that companies can understand your likes, your dislikes, and most importantly, what you're likely to buy in the future. Think about when someone buys a shiny new minivan. A lot of assumptions are made. The companies that are selling baby products are assuming you may need a high chair, baby food, diapers. Other companies that sell related products to your behavior may also assume that that gym membership may be in jeopardy, that those couples-only vacations may become few and far between. So a profile is built on, off of that single purchase of the minivan.
Right. Now, but in B2B, isn't it trickier in that most B2B sales are more complex, like they have to go through layers of bureaucracy in order to close the sale?
It is more complex in B2B, but that's where we add a significant amount of value by helping companies identify which companies are the right ones to target.
Mm-hmm. So how do you guys go to market? Are you eating your own cooking, or are you using this yourself?
Yeah, they have this magic tool to bubble up all the right prospects.
Right? We have analyzed our customers.
Right.
We have about 2,700 customers, and we've analyzed the behavior, how those companies look and how those companies act. And we've come up with a behavioral profile, and we've used that data to identify the companies that could get the most value from what we sell.
Now, can you share maybe some mistakes that some companies make currently and that you see all the time that maybe you're like, why are these people doing the same mistake over and over?
Yeah, it's a lot of companies are still marketing like it's 1999, and I was guilty of that for many years, where I would develop a profile of what I thought my companies looked like, what right. my targets looked like. The target profile for one of my previous companies, it was manufacturing companies in North America with greater than $1 million in revenue and lots of field locations. So if I went to my favorite list boat broker with that information.
You'd give them that data, and then they would send you some sticky labels, right?
They would provide me a list,
right?
And then I'd market to that list, and I'd generate not so good leads, and I'd give the leads to sales, and I'd try to convince sales.
And
that
you'd
the
like,
leads
what are you doing? I gave you the Glengarry leads. Why aren't
exactly,
you closing?
Exactly. But now, rather than marketing to the masses, we know which companies are the companies that look and act most like our current customers. Mm-hmm. So it makes the sales and marketing process much more efficient. One of our customers is a third-party logistics provider. They provide shipping services. And they were marketing like it was 1999. They were marketing to the masses. They had their inside sales teams calling out to the masses, and they didn't have revenue scaling at the rate that they wanted it to.
Right.
So they used our solution, which is called Lookalikes, and they were able to increase year-over-year revenue 10% and improve the effectiveness of their sales reps by 6%. Excuse me, six times.
Wow. So that's dramatic.
Okay, so I want you to walk us through this. I want to get some of this real-time free consulting. It's our compensation here for hosting the show, right, Lee? Not a lot of cash in this business. So we are a business-to-business platform. We only do business-to-business interviews. We help companies, select companies that fit a certain profile, become the de facto media outlet for the specific community that they serve. So we've got a pretty good feel. Professional services are good prospects for us. Law firms, CPAs, consulting firms. So right now, we think we know that. We get a chance to meet them. One of the ways we meet them is we invite them to come and visit with us on the show. How might we start a conversation with you guys? Walk us through at least the front end of that engagement cycle, if you will, if we were to work with you guys.
Sure. You'd start by providing us with a sample set of your customers, and then we would model the behavior of those customers. So we would know how those customers buy, how they pay, how they interact with other companies, and armed with that behavioral profile, we would do a search against our database, and we would serve up the companies that look most like your current customers or those companies that have the highest propensity to buy your services.
And then the thing that you're delivering back to us is the name of the company.
Exactly. It's a list of the companies that share look the most like your current customers.
Right, that match the qualities of our current clients.
Exactly.
And then we sit Kevin on them, right?
And that's it.
And then Kevin goes
do you help us with the next step of actually reaching out to them and marketing to them?
No, you're on your own after that.
you must have vendors you recommend or
actually,
work with?
We don't. We are providing the data that
enables.
That's it. We, at our core, we are a behavioral data company.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys are not based in Atlanta, but you have some boots on the ground here in Atlanta.
We do.
Is that right?
We do.
So how big are you, and what? How far are do your arms reach?
We have about 110 employees. We have our main office is in Boca Raton. We have an office in Boston, and we have an office in Bangalore. And then we have a number of sales and marketing folks that are spread around the country.
And then so you have people that work in the Atlanta market?
We do. I'm here, and I have a number of members of the marketing team that reside in Atlanta, as well as some sales.
And they're here to target Atlanta-based firms?
Not necessarily. We are targeting national firms, mm-hmm. but we have a number of Atlanta customers.
So what's next for you guys? What you're doing is working. Maybe you're not going to do anything new and different, but how do you see yourself investing your energy in the coming 6-8 months?
We continue to perfect our data. You know, the more data that you have, the more valuable the services are that we can provide to our customers, and making it easy for them to figure out which customers to market to, and also which ones not to market to. We didn't cover that.
Yeah, talk right. to that a little bit. That's every bit as important, if not more so.
It
right?
is. It is. Let me share just a quick case study. There's a company called Mayville Products that was a manufacturer that had been around for many, many years. And if you viewed them through the lens of credit, they had near-perfect credit scores for many, many years. Up until about a year ago, when their credit score just fell off a cliff, and then they issued a press release announcing that they were closing their plants and laying off their employees. Now, if you were a supplier or a vendor that had sold to them just prior to that unfortunate day and extended credit, you would have been in not such a great
right.
situation.
Yeah.
And that's looking at that company through the lens of credit. Now, if you look at that same company through the lens of purchase behavior, which is one of the main things that we track, you would have seen that 14 months prior to that company going out of business, there was a sharp decline in their purchase of raw materials. Now, when a manufacturer stops purchasing raw materials, that's a flag on the play.
Yes.
The next thing that we noticed was a sharp decline in their purchase of shipping services. When a manufacturer stops shipping,
right.
we know there's
a
problem.
So they're not purchasing materials or shipping. There's danger.
So if you had evaluated that company through the purchase behavior lens, you would have known 14 months in advance of that unfortunate day that they were having some financial problems.
Mm-hmm.
So by doing that, you would know which companies not to market to or which companies not to extend credit to.
Man, this is powerful mojo. What's the best way for our listeners to reach out, get in touch with you guys, and learn more about this and how they might apply it to their business?
Yeah, the best way is to visit our website. We have a number of case studies, ebooks, white papers that explain the whole concept of behavioral profiling and how you can use behavioral data to improve revenue, improve marketing efficiency, and reduce revenue risk.
Now, are the people that typically contact you, are they the director of sales or the CEOs? Who do you normally first interact with?
It's typically someone on the credit side of the house, finance side of the house, sales or marketing. In smaller companies, it can be the CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the beautiful, one of the many cool things about this solution is it can be used by companies of all sizes. Typically, if you have more than 100 customers, you can get a tremendous amount of value out of the solutions that we offer.
Well, thanks so much for coming in the studio and visiting with us this morning. And I'm thinking, Lee, I think it might be fun if you'd be up for this, is to come back with a client and have a conversation on air with a client and have them speak to how you guys work together. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that would be a lot of fun. We'll definitely
you'd
take
up
you up
that?
On that. Absolutely.
All
That'd
right.
be a lot of fun.
Hey, how about hanging out with us while we visit with our next guest?
Sure. Be happy to.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us two wonderful ladies from Infinite Strategies Group, LLC. Please join me in welcoming to the show Miss Lori Dubuque and Sue Johnson. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, we are delighted to have you. Did you learn anything out of that last segment? You going to go to market any differently, maybe?
It's fascinating. Yes.
No, it's amazing how much data we're all creating and how much we can really do with it. I mean, well, early next week, Lee, you and I, we're going to do a remote broadcast at
the big data conference here in town.
Yeah. So, yeah, fascinating conversation. But let's hear a little bit about Infinite Strategies and what you guys are out there trying to do for folks. Lori, get us caught up. Get us a thumbnail sketch, if you will, about your business and how you guys are out there serving.
Super. We are a human resources consulting firm. We specialize in organizational design and effectiveness and change management, as well as personal and executive coaching. So we have a multitude of products that we offer. Specifically, we've been seeing a lot around change management lately, especially with the changes in technology. Companies are really needing to be aggressive with regard to their what their strategies are and making sure that their employee base and their organization is in line with that.
And Sue, what's your role in all this?
Well, I'm an independent consultant, and I collaborate frequently with Lori. So
can you talk a little bit about change management? Like, can you define the terms for people who aren't familiar?
Change management, a lot of times what people think is that it's a communication plan. In reality, it's not just a communication plan. It's really looking at what is the vision of where you want to go, what is the future going to look like, and then what changes you need to make with regard to the employees, what type of communication you need to put in place, and really how are you going to sell whatever your vision is to the hearts and minds of your employees so that you get full engagement.
I'll tell you what, you can't sell it on the inside. You can't sell it on the outside, can you, Sue?
Nope.
It's the people that come up to works, right?
Absolutely. It's all about the people. It really needs to be a thoughtful, planful kind of approach to not only accepting change yourself, but helping other people work through it.
So both of you, in your own business, what in the world prompted you to, you probably had a nice cushy job in some big firm, right?
I did.
Talk to
Actually,
that
we both did.
Then you got to experience change management.
Firsthand, right.
I can actually coach on personal change management because I've been through it. I've had over 20 years at Fortune 500 companies. I left a cushy, as you would say, job with a Fortune 500 company. And made a decision to invest in myself. You know, so many companies have trained me in whether it be coaching or dealing with executive change. And I figured, you know, why not take all of this experience and start working with other companies? So it's been so much fun. I've been doing it for a little over a year, and I could not think, I love my boss. You know, what can I say?
Well, if you want to see what the rest of the path looks like, if and when this thing ever hits the rocks, then you can become a radio host. That's how it all unfolds.
So you'll be inviting me back soon.
Exactly. Maybe you guys could describe a project that you've worked on, what things looked like when you got there, some of the things you did, and then how you left it or how you're working with them now kind of in that secondary phase?
Well, we can talk to a number of different projects, and one being with regard to a model. Let's say you have your organization looking like one thing, and you have a vision of what the next phase is going to look like. And with one particular large company, it was going in and saying, okay, you implemented this a year ago, but you didn't measure it. You didn't do anything about what you visualized the change to look like. So it was just left there. You just communicated it. You said, this is what it's going to look like, and that's it. So what happens is we came in and basically looked at where they wanted to go and said, okay, here are your gaps in your talent. This is the type of training you need to do. Here are the gaps with regard to your leadership. Your leaders are not understanding completely the vision that you're trying to implement. And here's how we suggest you communicate it. And it's also about telling people what you've done and what you're going to do as well. And we forget to tell people what we've done and what we're going to do so often. We just do the initial communication of here's where we're going, right. Here's an email, here's a newsletter.
But thanks for playing.
Yes,
right?
Thanks for playing. We're going to go away for a weekend as executives, make a decision, and then we're gonna just
tell you what it is. Right.
Send you and tell you what it is.
And isn't that one of the most damaging things you can do is get everybody all fired up about this new direction and then not take some action in that direction and let people know you've taken some action because then they don't feel like it's not genuine, it's not authentic, and they're not going to listen to the next one, right?
Well, that is such a common mistake. People think that, especially if they are executives and they've gone off to their weekend retreat,
right.
And you know they've struggled with it and thrashed around with what the new concept should be. They're all bought in. They come back and just want to tell and walk away, and it doesn't work. People need time to digest. They need to understand. They need to be able to buy into it.
And then what are some of the strategies to get that level of trust up so that they do buy into it?
You have to be able to really articulate what that vision is so people can see it and feel it and especially understand how it will impact them personally.
So it's the what's in it for me. You got to kind of look at it through
the
a little empathy gene you need, right?
Absolutely.
It's going to impact other people.
And then you got to stick with it. You got to show each and every day that this is still your goal, and that you're that this is still what you want to do, and that you still understand that they're being impacted and that you're going to help them with it.
But how do you work with the company that, you know, it seems some companies, they read a new book this year, and then all of a sudden now we have a new plan because there's a new book on the New York Times bestseller list. You're laughing? Is that
seen that before, have you?
Has that happened?
And then the people are like, what's going on? Last week we were moving cheese, and now this week we're good to great. You know, like, what is it? What are we doing here?
You'll read it. It's the flavor of the month. So the employees are like, okay, here we go again. They've read another book, right? And here's the change. You know what? You can use some of the concepts from the book, but keep the change, so that you can say, yes, we are still putting this change in place. But the reality of it is that, you know, maybe the initial thought of how we were going to implement it isn't fully baked. Because not always does your vision, if you have a five-year vision, will it be that
I mean, because the market can't be set in stone. I mean, things change.
Absolutely.
But are the, you know, kind of the frontline employees, are they open to that, to being that nimble? Like, don't they, a lot of them want to be told, like, okay, relax, everything, we know what we're doing.
Do you like to be told relax when everybody else knows what they're doing?
Well, the thing is, like, you want to be, on one hand, you want to say be nimble and adjust to what's happening, but on the other hand, there's a bunch of people that want to be, you know, kind of are security minded, that want to know that, hey, that this ship isn't about to sink.
Well, everybody reacts differently. I think you have to address all of those. There are some people that just want to know what the direction is going to be, and that's part of how you communicate to them.
Right.
But for the most part, people like to know what, when, where, why, how.
Right.
They want the details.
And do they want that level of transparency? They want to know?
Absolutely.
So I am developing a theory of change, the Stone theory of change, as a product of this conversation. No, it strikes me that what makes the characteristics, the traits that makes for a good change leader are probably not a great deal unlike what makes a good parent. I mean, there needs to be some consistency. As a parent, you can't say, okay, we're going to use the Spock method this month, and then we're going to use corporate punishment next month, and then, right? I mean, is there some truth to that in your opinion?
I think there's some truth to it. But what you don't want to do as a leader is be too parental and try to protect them like you would a child from everything.
Okay, so we won't publish the Stone Theory, but it was still it was still worth asking the
good
question.
Try.
So if I'm an organization, I'm leading an organization, I know that we're going through some change. I know that it's not going to stop. We're only going to continue to go through more and more change. I am seriously thinking about engaging an organization like Infinite Strategies to help guide us through that. But, you know, this is not something I buy every day. How do I know who to choose? What kind of questions would I even ask a consulting group like you to just know if it's even the right path to go?
You know, I would say that there are a number of organizations out there that will help you with change, and there are some organizations that subscribe to a specific change methodology. So if you look at a Booz Allen or Connor Partners, they're going to have very different ways of approaching change. I would say really know how you want to approach change. What is your culture going to allow or not allow? How nimble are you? How deep do you want to get within the organization? And then decide where you want to go from there. It's also a matter of liking the individuals that you're working with, too.
Sure.
Are they listening to what I want, or are they really focused in on what they want? And that's why I love owning my own business, because I do listen to what other people want, because if I have my own agenda, it's not going to happen.
You know, I've seen a term in your literature, and it makes perfect sense to me, and I'd like to dive into it a little bit. It makes perfect sense to me that leaders of change have to be incredibly resilient and have to have the capacity to build resilient organizations. You guys are doing some very specific work in that arena. Speak to resilience a little bit, if you will. What is it? How do you develop it? And what's it going to cost you if you don't?
Okay, resilience basically is just your ability or your capacity to personally work through change. Because if you're not good and right with the change yourself, you're not going to be able to help anyone else do it. So it's just a great leadership skill and a great life skill for anyone to have. I think you need to, you know, think about how well you accept change and this is a lot of the executive coaching that we get into is working with people on this. How well they're able to accept change, do they look at it with a positive attitude? Are they able to stay focused on it when they decide that they're ready to move through something? Other attributes of a resilient person. Lori, help me out with that one.
So for resiliency, I think of a leader that is able to accept the change within the organization and to able to paint the picture of what the organization, where they're trying to go. And I think, as Sue said, it's really to be of your own heart and mind, know that this is the right way to go. I think that's what makes you a strong leader, and the ability to understand it, own it, and then be able to communicate it.
And I'm thinking maybe have some empathy for the folks that actually had to do it, too, because I know here in my organization, I can say, we're going to change the way that we edit audio on the backside of these interviews. Okay, I'm done now. I've owned it. I've accepted. I'm cool with it. Now poor Kevin's got to go home, buy different software, do things differently. His whole editing thing, right? So there's something to that piece of it, too, right?
Understanding the impacts to people and being able to speak to that with each individual is really important.
Or just hire resilient people that can adapt to whatever thought that pops into his head.
Absolutely.
That's helpful.
That's what I want.
It may be difficult, but yes.
Right.
Anticipate my needs, my desires, exactly. And all that, and just act on it. So I know you guys, as much work as you do, and as well respected as you are in this arena, you must have just example after example of you go into a situation and you see one or more mistakes being made, and you roll your eyes and you go, here we go again, mistake number 13. What are some of the major mistakes that you've seen that they're predictable? You see them over and over, and maybe we could avoid them and save ourselves some real pain and heartache if we knew about them now.
Well, I would say, you can piggyback off of me, I would say number one is really know your audience. Know how to paint the picture of what change is going to look like for them so that they understand the vision, so that they can walk the walk with you and be able to really be engaged in whatever this change is. And also, if there is any type of resistance, listen to it. Because while change is difficult and people... you try to be empathetic and you try to understand what they're going through, you need to listen to what resistance is out there, because that will help you to determine, is my communication plan right? Is it for the people? Are people really hearing what I'm saying? Are they understanding what I'm painting right now? I would say that's one. The other one would be measuring your effectiveness in the change itself. Continue to measure what you're doing. Is it really impacting the organization the way you expected, or is it not? Are you getting more clients? Are clients getting upset with the changes that you've made? And if you are you losing clients because of the changes that you made?
So build in some accountability.
Absolutely.
Like from day one.
From day one.
Not like after we've done this for a month or two.
That is another big mistake that I see. We implement the change. We hope that it's adopted, but we don't measure what the change has been. So that stops the flavor of the month. It really helps you to have a consistent process.
And I would just add to that a couple of things. One would be a really common leader mistake that I see is wanting to delegate all of the business around
change.
Why
are you looking at me?
She knows. He is the chief delegator. He is the delegator.
That folks don't think you're sincere, and they don't buy into the magnitude of the change if they think that you're washing your hands of it. And the other one that I think we should not miss is understanding your culture and your company's ability to absorb or deal with the kind of change. Lori and I had a conversation yesterday about JCPenney's and their recent CEO change, and it's all about what that culture and that environment is able to withstand and deal with in a period of time, and they obviously had not considered that.
It is human nature, though, as a leader, I would think, or maybe it's just Stone's nature to just want to shut down the resistance or...
Just
power through it. And one thing that I have seen, even in our own little organization, we might talk about some changes that everybody, they're all fired up about. And so I was like, we got no resistance here. But then when some of the real data comes in about what it really means to the day-to-day work and the way, you know, reporting relationships are changing or how I'm going to be measured and what I'm doing, now you start seeing some resistance. So this resistance thing, you really got to get your arms around it. And if nothing else, you can't avoid it, right? I mean, you can't avoid it.
You can't avoid.
And you shouldn't.
You shouldn't at all. Again, it's really important to know what the resistance is. And for your previous question, you said, what are some of the mistakes? The other one is knowing who your stakeholders are. Because when you go through change, and if you do not communicate to all the people that are being impacted by the change, you will get resistance from them as well. And it may impact their particular part of the business. And without even thinking about it, you know, you don't do it maliciously, but it's understanding who all those people are and figuring out what their resistance is going to be as well. So, yes, absolutely, listening to what they say.
And resistance isn't always a negative thing, and it's frequently not anything that you can see.
Right.
A lot of people probably don't even think they are being resistant, but... They don't understand what the change is, or they're going off in the wrong direction, or they haven't been trained to accept the new technology or whatever. That all kind of falls under that resistance umbrella. You just need to know what your roadblocks or your engagement level of everyone is at all times if you want to be successful.
Lee, I don't want to stop this conversation.
I know. This is your sweet spot.
I almost made a living in part of this arena at one time, and I love this stuff. You guys are doing such fabulous work. And we are going to stop it for now, but I'm going to say the same thing to you guys that we did to our first guest. I think it would be a fabulous idea and a lot of value to our listeners if we had you guys come back and maybe bring a client, a local client, and just talk through an engagement. You guys be up for that sometime?
Totally.
Absolutely.
Don't you think that would make for a cool episode? All right. So let's make sure that our listeners have your contact information. They can reach out and have a conversation with you.
Okay. They can contact us or they can check out our website at isg-llc.com. It provides all the suite of products that we have as well as how to get a hold of us.
Well, thank you again both for coming in the studio. It's been an absolute delight and quite sincere in that offer and that idea. We definitely want to have you back.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
You guys going to hang with us while we visit with our sharks?
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much. So, Lee, this next segment, this is exciting. You know, we were talking with Larry White.
It's not a party, Gary.
Oh,
my
God. People are throwing things. The sharks are here. Everything gets disrupted when the sharks show up. But, no, you know, we've been talking with Larry White over at the Rich Group.
Yeah, for quite some time.
And he crafted this idea. He's had two or three or four of these events where, I don't know, you know more. You went to one of these shark attack things. What happens in it? What was your experience when you went to your first shark attack?
It was really neat. It was like you ever watch the show Shark Tank?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So it's similar where you get a bunch of investors talking to a bunch of people that need money.
Right. Well, you don't know what you're talking about. Let's talk
exactly
to these folks.
Is.
So we have two sharks with us. Is that right?
Two and a half.
And two and a half sharks with us. Plus we got the handler and more sharks coming. All right. All right, Gary, you're going to have to give up your seat for another shark.
Gary, if you want to sit back, there's a chair back here.
Yeah, you can keep an eye on Kevin and make sure
he's
pushing
the
right buttons. And then we'll have our third shark put on your headphones. And say anything you want. Just say it right into the very end of the microphone. Let's go around the horn, have our sharks introduce themselves, and we'll start with you. Tell us who you are.
Hello, my name is Candace Klein, and I am an angel investor. I've invested in about 50 companies myself through my first business, which is called Bad Girl Ventures.
Nice.
I invest in women-owned businesses, and then I started my second company, which is a crowdfunding platform for low-interest loans, and that company is called Somo Lend, and I'll be one of the sharks today.
Fantastic. And then your next venture will probably be a media investing company, right? For like internet radio.
Oh, I have another 30 businesses waiting to happen. You just wait and see.
Perfect.
All right. And you, sir.
Sure. My name is Jonathan Wilson, and I'm an attorney right here in Atlanta at a firm called Taylor English Duma. And I'm also going to be one of the sharks. I'm a corporate and securities lawyer. I do a lot of work with startups and small businesses. And a lot of those folks are going to want to take advantage of crowdfunding as soon as it becomes available.
Fantastic. And Maurice?
Well, my name is Maurice Lopez.
I got that right.
Yeah, I'm the founder of Early Shares. We are one of the premier crowdfunding platforms for equity-based transactions. And we're also excited to get this ball rolling.
All right. So why don't you educate our listeners a little bit about the crowdfunding? It's been in the news quite a bit over the last, what, 6-8 months?
Oh, year or so? More. Yeah.
Is it fully baked? Is it ready for operation? Can people start participating in it, or is it the rules?
The answer is most simply no.
No, it isn't.
Yeah. So the Jobs Act was passed at the federal level on April 5th of 2012.
Right.
The Jobs Act has two titles that are relevant to today's conversation. One is Title II, which allows for businesses to generally solicit from the general public if they'd like to raise money. The issue with Title II, though, is that if you want to raise money by posting an ad in the Wall Street Journal, you have to only be able to accept money from accredited investors who've made $200,000 or more per year for the past 2 years or have $1 million in net.
Is that different than an angel investor?
Most angel investors are accredited investors. So you can solicit, but the money you take has to be from high net worth people.
Right.
Title III allows the rest of us to invest. So that allows for accredited or unaccredited investors, everyday people, to start making investments in businesses and getting a return on their investment, either through a share of equity, like at early shares, or a return on investment through an interest rate return, like debt on SomoLend. The issue with Title III is that rather than posting an ad in the Wall Street Journal, you have to actually reach out via a portal, a funding portal. So that ensures that there's been some due diligence mm-hmm. on your business, that the investors have some education before they make their investment decision.
But how is it different than Kickstarter?
Kickstarter allows for people to give their money away. So
you could get a t-shirt.
Well, you could, maybe, sure. Someday, but you're not signing a contract that you're right. actually going to get that t-shirt. So the two models that you're seeing right now with Kickstarter, Indiegogo, Rocket Hub, and others allow for individuals to give their money away through donation or rewards. So you're not actually getting a return on your investment. You're just getting some, either you feel good or you get some tangible item in return.
But aren't companies using that to start up, to fund initial
production? Sure, it's a great first step in the capital formation process.
Right.
Investors aren't investing like it's 1999 anymore.
Right.
And so what I would say is that these people are purchasing the products. It's a great way to pre-sell your product. That same business that has a successful Kickstarter campaign should next be going to early shares or SomoLend.
Right.
And so we're simply filling out the rest of the process for that small business owner.
Now, do you guys have any timeline of when this is going to be fully blessed by the government to...
Jonathan, yeah, does. Yeah.
Jonathan, go ahead.
Well,
what date?
Well,
mark my calendar.
what hour and minute, by the way, we want to know.
Well, the great thing was Congress did mark our calendars. And, you know, even those of us who didn't go to law school remember from Schoolhouse Rock that after Congress passes the bill and the president signs it, it's supposed to become a law.
Right.
Somehow that didn't make it all the way to the SEC. They were supposed to have adopted regulations to implement crowdfunding, I think, by the end of 2012. And yet, for a variety of reasons, we can speculate what all those reasons are, the SEC just hasn't adopted the regulations. And until the regulations come out, you just can't do.
So everybody's in a holding pattern?
We are turning blue in the face by holding our breath, yes.
But is Somo, I can still work with SomoLend?
Yep, so a lot of platforms like mine are operating under existing exemptions from today's securities laws. So we have banks lending on our platform. They're completely exempt from securities laws.
Right.
We have 506 offerings, so we have accredited investors making loans on our platform. And we're facilitating friends and family financing on our platform. And each of those have their own exemptions. Now, for us, the crowd will just be the fourth offering. So small businesses today can raise money from three different groups of people already.
But which they could have always done prior to this law.
They could have. Yeah. There wasn't really a platform that was providing that kind of streamlined access for them.
Yeah, let's talk more about this platform. Describe this platform to us.
Okay, I'll describe mine, and then I want Maurice to describe his, because
he's
my
Maurice
partner in crime.
Well, let Maurice go first.
Yeah, okay.
Go ahead, Maurice.
Well, the concept, when the bill was put together, the idea would be that there would be websites. We're called platforms, but they're really websites, right? These are websites that can basically be, let's say, the eBay of crowdfunding, right? So you match the buyer and the seller. So here you have investors, which are in this case, we're talking about Title III, which is the average American that wants to invest $100 or $1,000.
Everyday Jane,
right.
Instead of Joe.
That wants to invest $100 or $1,000 into a promising startup he knows, or his cousin's company, or you know, usually it's within their network, right? And then the company that also is looking for funding goes on the platform and has to go through that due diligence process. So the idea of the portal or the funding platform is that it becomes this clearinghouse where it matches everybody together. But let's not have any misconceptions about this. If you look at crowdfunding, the way it works today in donation-based and in perks-based, as well as what's going on in Europe already, it's been equity-based crowdfunding has been going on in Europe for a year and a half now. Very well, very successfully, zero fraud, lots of great news, lots of companies doing exactly what we're waiting to do here. Right, we're not the first ones to invent this. This is not something, you know, brand new wheel invented. It's already been going on in Australia for 5 years. It's been going on in the UK for a year and a half. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been crowdfunded for equity. Okay, but so one of the things I wanted to say was a misperception is that
for securities, debt,
yes.
And equity.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So is that it's not an easy process. You're not going to just put your company on a platform like EarlyShares or someone, and then it's all of a sudden thousands and thousands of investors are going to jump in and give you money, right? There's a level of – we see this on campaigns, on Kickstarter and everything, and on other platforms, that there is that 30 or 40% tipping point where you've got – if you don't hit that 30 or 40% tipping point, the rest of the crowd that you don't know, that third, fourth generation of people that are connection of a connection, don't jump in and say, oh, that's a really good idea. I want that watch, or I really like that watch company. I'd like to invest in them. So it really needs – what that does is it provides a little bit of validation, a little bit of security too. It's like the restaurant theory, right? You walk by a restaurant, you see there's two restaurants like each other. One is like 100 people in line waiting, and the other one's completely empty. Mm-hmm. And you're in a hurry. You look at your watch, and you look at both restaurants, but you still get in line at the other one, right? It's that crowd herd effect because you assume that there's a reason why everybody's in that line. You don't want to be the first one in. You don't know what you don't know, right? So that 30%, 40% tipping point seems to be the average that the average investor will jump in after the family and friends and their connections and their network jumps in and backs that company. It's that validation of the concept as well.
So I don't know if you guys have ever watched Sex and the City. I'm assuming not because I'm talking to a bunch of boys. But I do. And when Smith Jared, an actor, was afraid he wasn't going to become famous, his girlfriend Samantha said, honey, first come the girls, then come the gays, then come the industry. And that's essentially what happens in crowdfunding. First come your friends and family.
Right.
Then come the people in your community who already know you. And then come the crowd.
But is it possible to kind of help yourself by pulling a celebrity in, like the Veronica Mars kind of phenomenon on Kickstarter, where you get a known brand that went out of business, the show got mm-hmm. canceled, and then they got an influx of, they said, hey, we're going to throw this out there, and all of a sudden they get, $6 million in a few weeks? Is it the same thing here where I can throw somebody on my board that's a known commodity?
Well, every startup does that, right? So you all try to find – every startup tries to find star appeal. So if you can get, somebody from the PayPal mafia as a tech startup on your board of directors, you're set.
Right.
You'll get investors. So that's a tried and true technique that always works. What I will say, though, is that with securities-based crowdfunding, once that is fully implemented sometime in 2014, my bet is still first quarter, but we'll see, is that investors have a lot more that they're taking into account. Having just a celebrity works for a Kickstarter, it's not going to work so well for debt and equity because we want to look at the business plan. We want to see that you're actually going to make money.
Right, but when it opens up to Jane Doe, or what'd you call her? Jane Doe.
The Everyday Jane.
Everyday Jane.
Yeah.
Aren't they going to be influenced? Aren't they more influenceable?
Well, that's actually pointing to a great reason of why crowdfunding exists. And we hadn't told that story yet, but I think it's a great reason for why crowdfunding is supposed to be. And that is back in the 1800s, there was a writer who observed a county fair in England. And they had one of these contests, guess the weight of the cow. And if you guess the weight of the cow, you won a prize. And they had a panel of judges who were experts in animal husbandry, and they all made their guesses. And then they also let people just from the passing public make their own guesses. What they found is that the most accurate guess came from the accumulation of all the guesses of the average people in the public, not the experts. And the idea is that the crowd can be in a very efficient source of finding out the truth. And the hope is that for a lot of these small businesses trying to raise money, by having a crowd of people kicking the business plan, thinking about it, comparing notes, pulling in their own information.
Talking about it with each other.
Exactly. The crowd is going to be able to decide which startups, which small businesses are most worthy of getting funded. And it's not going to depend on star appeal or whether you're part of the PayPal mafia. The crowd is going to come up with the best guess.
Mm-hmm.
And is the presumption that crowdfunding is going to serve what might be underserved markets, businesses like minorities and women? women? And
So SomaLend is a we're 2 years old. We'll be 2 years old on May the 11th. So we'll have a birthday party. We'll come back to your show. You haven't invited me yet, but I'm definitely coming back.
There's Candace for you.
but in the past year and a half, we've had thousands of borrowers raise capital on our platform successfully. And what a couple of things that are interesting. First, they're not tech startups. They're everyday businesses, restaurants, retailers, food trucks, salons, gyms. These are the businesses who have loyal customers who want to get in on the deal, who've never been able to raise money from those people before. The other thing that's interesting is that 70% of our borrowers are women and minorities. 70% of our individual lenders are women and minorities. Wow. And then I'll shut up. But women, as an example, we represent 51% of all privately held companies now in the United States, yet we have access to less than 5% of traditional capital, less than 3% of venture capital, yet 70% of our successful borrowers so far have been women and minorities. That's a really cool and interesting statistic.
Now,
that's why it's called Bad Girl Venture.
Yeah. Why would it be Bad Girl? That would be Good Girl. Now, why do you think that is? Is it because they share these opportunities amongst themselves better?
I promise that I won't do all the talking, but so I started SomaLend because of Bad Girl Ventures, because of my first company. My first company is a school, and I used behavioral underwriting, much like your first speaker today, to understand whether there was risk rather than FICO score. And I had 3,000 women apply to come through my program in Cincinnati, Ohio, in my first year of operation, and I could only invest in 50. So I thought, what do I do for the rest? One of the cool things I was noticing, though, that they were doing is they were lending to each other under the table in the classroom environment. That's cool, but that's never going to help them become bankable. So I thought, what if I could create a platform that could teach these businesses how to raise money from their own social networks and track the repayment of those loans so they can one day become bankable? It's new data, right? And that was the reason for starting SomaLend. So what we've learned about, particularly women, and I can let others speak to minorities, is that we are very social in nature. We are willing to support the people that we know and trust. And that's not typically banks. We don't normally trust banks. It's very intimidating to walk into an ivory tower and ask for money.
So other legislation that's impacting this? Is there other legislation or other news about legislation?
Jonathan, can you tell us a little bit about statewide? I mean, is some interstate?
Sure. No, on the federal level, we're sort of stalled as far as securities-based crowdfunding until the SEC gives us regulations. There are a handful of states, and Georgia is one of them, where state regulators have tried to kickstart, if you will, crowdfunding all on their own. And in Georgia, we have a regulation called the Invest Georgia Exemption. It was adopted by the Commissioner of Securities about a year ago that would allow someone to do securities-based crowdfunding in Georgia, where the issuer of the securities is a company organized in Georgia and where all of the investors are organized in Georgia, and they can raise up to $1 million in a year using that method. Now, the thing about crowdfunding is that the first thing you need is a crowd.
Right. So, that's the hard part.
Right. So the challenge is so
write
far,
that quote down for the PR release.
Yeah. Sometimes it takes the lawyer to come up with the really keen insight. You know. But what we're looking for is someone to really become that first crowdfunding portal in Georgia to take advantage of this intrastate Invest Georgia exemption.
And listeners, this is a business opportunity.
That's right. I'm just giving you the business plan. There it is.
Ladies listening to the show. We're counting on the 70%.
So now, I would think that crowdfunding, it sounds really good for the business owner. Are the angels and the VCs, are they on board with crowdfunding? Are they excited that this crowdfunding thing is going to happen, or are they sort of part of the problem of making it not available just yet?
So I'm an angel investor just like Candace is, and one of the things that, you know, you see lots and lots of deals, and the issue is, you're like, one of the first questions you ask is, oh, so how many sales, how much you have in sales? How's it going? You know, where's your distribution? You know, tell me why you deserve my money, right? And a lot of times they have a hard time showing that traction. Oh, we're about to get this contract, or we have soft orders, or I have a PO, but I haven't been able to, I need the money to go buy it. I'm like, really? Have you ever factored
it's like
in
the
before?
Deadbeat boyfriend. Baby, I promise I'm going to make some money someday.
Yeah, someday.
Yeah. Tomorrow. Yeah.
That idea is going to pan out. Right. So crowdfunding plays a big part, I think, for angels now. And in the beginning, when the legislation was first proposed, I think there was a lot of pushback from VCs and angels. And now I think they've all come around pretty much to both sides of the table, which is interesting, because you can validate the traction of the company. So while there's been some very creative ways to encapsulate the crowd shareholders into a separate entity, and therefore it's only one voting right, one voting stock, and all that, which makes the angels and the VCs more comfortable, because their biggest issue has always been, well, you know, I don't do deals with 10 investors in it, you know, and now I'm going to invest in a company that has 1,000 investors in it. That's going to be a cap table nightmare. So, you know, a lot of companies like Early Shares have come up with creative ways to, you know, encapsulate the crowd of investors into one separate entity that then makes that one investment as a fund or whatever, or an SPV, and that becomes one shareholder that represents the whole group. So they still get the same amount of ownership. They still get the same return or possible return. But it cleans up the cap table. It makes it very viable and refundable project for VC money. But something else to remember is that only 1% of all companies. Everybody dreams about, you know, I'm going to start a company. I'm going to get seed capital. I'm going to go and do an A round and a B round and a C round. I'm going to do an IPO and we're all going to be billionaires. And the reality of it is less than 1% of all companies ever get past the B round or even the A round. So, you know, we're hoping that crowdfunding fills a gap that really isn't addressed so much by venture capitalists. And it's really a lot of the angel investors get to play in this space. But it's Main Street America that never gets any access to this kind of capital that's really going to benefit from crowdfunding.
Now, part of the thinking, though, of having angel investors be accredited investors, that you guys are smarter and you can absorb the losses. What's going to happen when the crowd gets involved and these people are betting on companies and they think that, it looks attractive and they're not as wise as you guys. They don't have the scar tissue and it sounds good. And those people start losing money at the rate that, you know, most angel investors and VCs, you know, they know going in that the majority aren't going to be home runs.
Well, the bill has very specific caps, right? So investment caps are, you're talking about $2,000 for somebody who makes under $100,000 a year.
Under $40,000 a year.
Well, it's 2,000 or 5% for...
Right.
So I mean, you're and if you go on when you go to platforms like ours and Somolin, there is a tremendous amount of education component to it. And we teach you, we have videos saying, you know, listen, if you're going to invest $2,000 of your retirement account or whatever it is, then, you know, put it into 20 investments of $100. Don't put it into one company, because we want you to diversify your portfolio. Mm-hmm. We want you to have fun in this and enjoy it. And it is risk capital. And, you know, you have to understand that, you know, startups are just like any other business in America.
Right.
Half of them will fail, you know, or, you know,
is
hopefully.
Is it half?
Well, it depends on who you ask.
Half of small businesses will fail in the first 5 years. That's an SBA statistic. Yeah.
So, you know, and we're all hoping that, you know, those statistics will change in the short term, because one of the main reasons that they fail is lack of access to capital. So if you're addressing that issue right off the bat, you know, those numbers should come down.
So you can
down.
Improve the odds,
right?
Theoretically.
Yeah. But there's other reasons companies fail, right?
I would also sort of challenge the assumption that just because you're an accredited investor and you make $200,000 a year.
That you're smart.
That you're smart. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Sure. You could just be lucky.
Maurice and I are idiots.
Exactly.
Well, think of all the other things that people do all the time in our economy that create all kinds of systemic risk for the business, for the economy, that have absolutely nothing to do with net worth. You know, we just went through a housing crisis because we made lots of $100,000, $500,000 loans to people that ultimately weren't good for it. And that process created a heck of a lot more damage than any broken startup I've ever heard about. I think that the whole assumption that a millionaire knows more than someone who's not is just a faulty assumption that might have worked in 1933, but isn't terribly applicable anymore.
I do think, though, that, and I'll play the devil's advocate, boys. I think that there will be lawsuits. People are going to get ticked off.
Oh, sure.
And
I'm not going to disagree with you on that one.
And so I would encourage the platforms to be thinking about, we're setting up a loan loss reserve fund. And so part of the money that we're raising for our platform is to protect in case there are lawsuits. And I think that portals particularly need to be aware of that and need to be planning for that very early on in the process.
And the way that you're planning is some of this education and the explaining how this all works.
Yeah,
and
like
the
one
risk,
of the things we do on our platform is our borrowers have to fill out the same type of application they would fill out at a bank, like the equivalent of an SBA loan application. We pull a credit report, criminal history for all the owners, all the directors, and then
I'm out.
and then
it was bad girl.
I know I'm the original bad girl, but I have a clean record. But what I would say though is we pull all of that information. We also require a business plan. We require that they actually have some form of corporate formation, so no sole proprietors are allowed. And so then at the end, when the lender is interested in making an investment, they have to fill out a quiz. They actually have to answer questions about the management team, about the financials, and it's kind of like Mad Libs, where we actually give them the answers. They just have to click on it. But it requires that they go through some of the important imperative questions about the business plan.
So tell us a little bit about this event before we wrap. What's this Shark Attack event going to be like, and what's the real purpose of it?
So,
what, anybody?
Do you hear? Well, you got the sharks here.
So the did they tell you guys anything? So, or they just said show up?
So the Ritz Group, as you had mentioned, is doing these shark attacks. They've done them before. I think that it's interesting that they've chosen three sharks who are in the crowdfunding space. So not only are we going to be looking at, okay, is this realistic? Do you have any customers? The typical questions. We're going to say, what's your marketing strategy? How are you going to be reaching the masses? Are you going to be using a crowdfunding strategy? And if so, do you have a plan? Have you thought about who your influencers are going to be? So I think our questions are going to be a bit tougher because we're going to be really focused on distribution and marketing strategy, because that's what makes a successful crowdfunding campaign.
So a crowdfunding campaign is different than an angel campaign or a VC campaign. You would attack that totally differently?
Well, you're trying to appeal to the crowd.
Right.
You know? But we're not doing as much yet because the regulations aren't there. But the whole idea is to pull together a whole bunch of people who are going to get excited about what you're doing, who are going to tell their friends and neighbors, to pull together a big group.
And for a VC or angel investment campaign, I just raised $2.2 million from angel investors and VCs. And I had to I had to sit down face-to-face with 220 different investors to get that money. I could not go into a room and say, here's my idea, la, because that is general solicitation. And so I think the interesting thing is, with crowdfunding, you're actually now able to tell the masses that you're raising capital.
So you can make a two-minute video.
And one of the things, one of the things I wanted to add to that, like, people that are hearing about crowdfunding the first time, and you know, there's a lot of misconceptions. And one of the things that I think that people would appreciate is that you've got this clarity that you don't have. Think about some of the, you know, when the legislation was proposed, there was a lot of talk about fraud. This is going to be fraud, right? Well, you know, it's funny how there's been no fraud overseas, and they've been doing this for very long. And the reason for that is that because the crowd can do a better job of vetting out
the bad guy.
They smell a rat.
A lot faster than one guy who's an MBA intern working.
Right.
And the other thing is that, now imagine that not only can you vet out these deals, but you vet out not just when you're looking at only from a perspective of fraud, then yeah, you might catch that one guy who's a shady guy who has a bad record or whatever, and that doesn't and then you don't make your investment as an angel, right?
Right.
Which probably would never happen on a crowdfunding because everybody would figure it out. But you're also vetting out the bad ideas. It's not just you're vetting out, you know, the bad guy.
So the good ideas bubble up, and then
because, you know,
they get traction faster.
You know, your wife might think you have a great idea for those, you know, pink headsets you have on, but when you ask 500 people, they say, "Well, maybe pink's
not
your color."
It's not a good look for you. Yeah.
But it strikes me that this event is really more. I think you're going to get more education out of it as a participant, as an attendee. It's more about that probably than it is about one or two people actually getting some money that night for their business.
It is supposed to be educational.
The purpose is for us to teach the audience not only the bait that are coming and pitching us, but also everyone else in the audience of what are some strategies that are tried and true that can work for you, that not only will work on Kickstarter, but will also work on early shares.
So let's get some contact information about these platforms and your services as well, Jonathan. Maurice, contact information coordinates for your platform?
Earlyshares.com. That's about it. It's really easy.
That's easy.
Yep. And we have a whole university section on there, which you can learn a lot, which I recommend anybody listening could go and check out, because it teaches you all about not only about crowdfunding, but what an equity is, or what a securities is. Now, we actually break it down so everybody can get an understanding, because people might not have invested before. And that's the whole point here, is that we get that other 99% of the country being able to invest in companies, not just the rich people.
Now, who should go to your website? Investors and
anybody.
I think up to
100,000 registered investors right now. So I mean, anybody can go in there. It doesn't cost anything. You just basically fill out your information. We keep you up to date on what's coming on, what's going on with the regulation, what's going on with the SEC. We have a monthly newsletter, and as soon as the floodgates open, then you'll be able to see the companies that we have. Few thousand companies that have applied for funding, and we put them all listed there. Once that Chinese wall comes up, then everybody can see each other.
And Jonathan?
Sure. Jonathan Wilson. Our law firm is Taylor English Duma. Our website is TaylorEnglishLikeTheLanguage.com, and we're 120 lawyers located here in Atlanta. And I don't think we have quite as much educational material as Maurice does, but we've got a crowdfunding white paper on our website, and easy to find my contact information there as well.
Candace?
So you can reach us at you can reach me directly through info@somoland. But go to somoland.com if you're a small business owner seeking capital. We now have 50 banks lending on our platform and thousands of individuals, accredited and otherwise. So we're looking for small business owners as well as institution and institutional investors. And so that's at somoland.com.
Now, if somebody wanted to go to the Shark Attack event, is the website?
The City Club of Buckhead tonight at 3 o'clock.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you all for being part of the show. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We'll see you all next week on Atlanta Business Radio.